Good morning, Ms. Kizak. Just a few questions for you in relation to your discussion of Overseer and the risk scorecard. So just wanted to start with a couple of questions in terms of consenting of farming activities. Would you accept from a planning perspective, a consenting perspective, that the key matters that any farm related consent, the conditions would relate to, would be the farm management practices themselves? Sure. So if a farm required resource consent under the PC1 provisions, would you expect that the conditions would relate to the farm practices themselves, the on-farm activities?
Yes.
And on that basis, would it follow that farmers with the highest risk management practices on farm would be the ones that would be subject to, or should be the subject of the greatest scrutiny through a consenting process?
The highest risk practices?
Well, the higher the risk management practice.
Sure.
Were you here last week when Mr. Broxock gave evidence? Would you accept his evidence in relation to the nitrogen risk scorecard addressing the key on-farm drivers of risk?
That's not really my area of expertise.
Would you accept, though, that his evidence was that it covered the key drivers?
Could you take me to his evidence?
This was in his answering the questions last week, did you hear him accept that the nitrogen risk scorecard did address the key drivers of risk?
I don't specifically.
Okay. I'd like to take you to paragraph 56 of your evidence in chief.
Yes.
I think it actually starts slightly earlier, but you have a discussion in there of the drafting tool for dairy, and so the overseer and the risk scorecard. You refer at paragraph 57 to the joint witness statement from August 2022.
Yes.
Would you accept that JWS confirmed that the risk scorecard was the only practical alternative to the overseer?
As I've stated in my evidence, I found that joint witness statement quite difficult to interpret, so I wouldn't like to reach any conclusions on that.
Okay, if we move down to paragraph 64 of your evidence, you round out your discussion of these different tools with reference to Te Whaimana and taking a precautionary approach to decision making. Now, would you accept that the Science Advisory Panel has raised concerns with use of Overseer?
That's the government panel that you're referring to?
Correct.
Yes, I see
that. And that included a lack of confidence in the Overseer outputs?
I don't recall exactly the outcomes.
Certainly. Could I take you to volume 501, tab 21? Volume 501.
Volume 2.
And tab 21. And so this is guidance from MFE. In response to the various reviews and work streams in relation to Overseer?
Sure.
Can I just take you down, it's about the fifth page of that document, 501.2207. Correct. And so if we just go to that top of that page, so this was the technical advisory review outcomes from 2022, and you'll see the second bullet point at the top of the page, that overseer FM output numbers should not be used as absolute numbers. And then there's been further 2023 validation work that it goes on to address. And then again, the bullet points, you'll see there it says, after discussions, TAG read they had increased confidence in overseer FM, however, the ministry's advice remains unchanged. And then again, that second bullet point suggests or states overseer FM output numbers should not be used as absolute numbers. So if we go back to paragraph 64 of your evidence where you refer to the need for a precautionary approach, I put it to you that use of overseer and reliance on overseer, given the various concerns that have been raised, including very recent MFE guidance that overseer output numbers should not be used as absolute numbers, that that's not necessarily a precautionary approach.
I would agree with that.
And so, would you accept that of the alternatives then to overseer that in relation to dairy, that the nitrogen risk scorecard is the most practical option?
I don't know enough about it, I'm sorry to be able to comment.
Okay, thank you. No further questions.
Thank you.
Going on holiday, taking right. Just to let you know, I'm handing out some material which I will ask you a question about. The council should have a copy. I'm just happy if you want to just have a look at it so that you know. What's what? Metal registrar is the witness. Fox got the markup. So just in front of you, you should have a copy of the stock exclusion regulations there. I think those are the ones you prefer to. Yep. You should have a bound copy, which if we could leave in the witness box, I please don't take away with you these provisions. Is there a copy? There should be a bound copy. Yeah, so at the bottom it should have brown font amendment sought by FFNZ and BLNZ. Yep, so we might need to go to that. And then there's the regulatory impact statement there. I might ask you some questions about that shortly. And then there's a diagram here which has got Bruce Cameron, Chief Beef Farmer Glenn Murray. And just for the benefit of the court, that's a combination of a number of different maps that we thought would be helpful to put in one place, and I'll ask Mr. Cameron to produce it, but it's just here to assist.
So it's a combination of the maps that are already in his
evidence? Yes, so the low spike map's already in, the paddock layout's already in, and the only addition is the stream layout that's been taken from a rec map and some other work. But it's indicative only, it's not intended to be precise. So if you just have a minute, I'll just grab it. Thank you, and then I'll come back to that, and if you could just have your evidence open as well, your primary evidence, and I'll ask you some questions about that. And just to give you a bit of a guideline, I'll ask you some general questions, and then go and specifically focus on the matters of concern in my client, which are primarily stock exclusion, ephemeral streams.
Okay.
In terms of couple of, so this is your first time giving expert evidence in the environment court?
Yes.
Welcome. Do you have any on-farm experience? Oh, sorry, did you grow up on a farm? Have you been on farms?
Yes.
Yep. And sheep and beef farm, dairy farm?
I grew up on a dairy farm.
Cool.
And I have family that have sheep and beef farm.
Cool. Yeah, no, that's just helpful. No, it's just helpful. It's helpful to some of the questions I might ask. And then you're aware that all the planners got invited to visit Mr. Berry's farm, and I think you took up that offer.
I did.
And that was helpful to understand on the ground.
Yeah, that's
great. Yeah. So we might have some questions about that later. Can you just confirm exactly when you were instructed? Roughly?
2017.
Oh, so were you involved in the council?
Yes.
Yeah, you were. Great. Okay, sorry, I just wasn't sure. I wasn't clear. It was unusual. Great. And then lastly, in terms of introduction, I don't think you filed any rebuttal evidence. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
So, but you read the other planning statements and the other proposed provisions that the other planners put up, but you didn't feel you needed to respond.
That's right.
So I take it from that you disagree. And the reason I'm asking is I'm going to ask you some questions about them, and I just wasn't sure what your reasons are, but can I assume that you disagree for the reasons you continue to set out in your primary evidence with the amendments that they proposed?
I guess largely yes, if you want to take me to something.
No, I just as a general, this is just general comments, so that's fine.
Yeah,
okay. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't missing a statement of evidence. Now, just some general planning principles. I think you were in the room when I was asking Mr. Trebilko some questions.
Yes.
Okay. Do you agree that, as a general planning principle, regulation should be applied with the lightest touch necessary to achieve the environmental outcome desired?
In some cases, yes.
So when do you think you wouldn't apply that principle?
It's not a principle that I personally apply. I can't really give you a specific example.
Okay. So, so you think that any work or effort required or rule in a plan should be in pursuit of a specific environmental outcome?
Yes, the environment definitely has to come into it, but there are other outcomes that will need to be considered as well and balanced with that outcome.
Yeah. In terms of Section 32, you'll be familiar with the requirements of Section 32 in the planning process?
Yes.
Any provision must be assessed against Section 32 or 32AA requirements?
Yes. Any changes to a provision will be needed to be assessed under Section 32AA.
Yeah. And in considering what's reasonably practicable, do you agree that there's a range of factors that need to... So this is reasonably practical in the Section 32 sense, so options. Do you agree there's a range of factors that need to be considered?
Yes.
So that would include the time that might be required to undertake any works?
Yes.
The cost of doing the works?
Yes.
The extent of obligations, time and cost imposed by other related rules? To ensure that an option is reasonably practicable, do you agree with me that the time frames for requiring that rule to be complied with is a relevant factor?
Yes.
So something might be practicable in 5 years, but not practicable in 1 year?
Yes.
And it's important, given the regulatory nature of rules, to be clear about when certain things have to be achieved by. And in terms of choosing a time period from a planning perspective, if there was no obvious or quantified benefit in achieving something earlier rather than later,
but achieving it earlier is practically very difficult. It would be more appropriate to choose the later date, wouldn't it?
As a general statement, yes.
In assessing whether an option is reasonably practicable for a Section 32 assessment, do you agree that the rules will affect different landowners differently depending on their individual circumstances on their farms?
Yes.
So some might find works very difficult, some may find them easier.
Yes,
yep. And there's an infinite number of possibilities in terms on a continuum. So farmers will sit on a continuum of ability to respond to certain rules, correct?
Yeah, everyone will sit on that continuum.
And so in setting rules and requirements, you can't set a rule that's based on either extreme. You need to set your rule requirements on an average farmer or a middle of the road farmer. How would you do that?
I wouldn't set my rules based on the individuals. I would be setting rules based on the outcomes to be achieved.
Yeah, but I think you agree with me that in discussing, and I'm not necessarily talking here about environmental outcomes, I'm talking about how long it might take to do it, to achieve these outcomes or comply with the regulations. But you need to accept when you are imposing a regulation to do something within a certain time, to be conscious that there will be a range of ability of farmers to respond within that time. In the context of PC1, do you agree that there's no expectation in these rules to achieve the ultimate outcomes within the next 10 years? It's a staged approach, isn't it?
Can you ask me that again?
PC1, the provisions to be imposed in the regional plan through PC1 are not intended to achieve the ultimate outcome of to the farm owner.
I understand the request.
And you agree in the context of a planning provision being effective in achieving what I think everyone is here to achieve, which is the health and restoration of the awa. Do you agree that everyone has to do their bit?
Yes.
So that would include farmers, urban dwellers, dock. Everyone has to play their part?
Everyone.
Do you, and then in terms of the efficiency of provisions, do you agree that's a relevant factor for consideration in the Section 32 test?
Yes, it's specifically required.
And do you agree that one definition of efficiency is that the outcome is achieved, the desired outcome is achieved with the least effort or cost? Well, how would you define an efficiency? And I appreciate it's probably a very open question, but from a planning perspective, how would you define efficiency? And I'm talking here about the efficiency of a certain rule. So take fence requirement, fence ephemeral streams. How would you test the efficiency of that rule?
The efficiency of the rule would need to be considered against the policies and objectives it's trying to achieve.
So you don't, in assessing that, do you have a consideration towards the resources required to achieve that outcome and measuring the efficiency of that?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Do you agree that when assessing, do you agree that you, in some circumstances, you'd need to undertake a cost-benefit analysis of imposing a particular rule?
I think that you would need to undertake cost-benefit analysis broadly and then potentially for a specific rule.
Do you think that the costs that the Director General is seeking in respect of the fencing off of ephemeral waterways across the entire PC1 catchment is a cost that should be quantified?
I think if we were able to do that, yes, that would be great.
Because the cost could be significant, couldn't it?
I'm not aware what the cost would be.
Because nobody's assessed it.
The information, as far as I'm aware, is not available to us.
And you agree that it would not be practicable, efficient, or effective to impose a rule that's simply not able to be complied with? Well, if it's simply not practicable to comply with it, or it's just simply too expensive, or it's...
But the rule has been imposed for a reason, and
yep.
You would need to weigh up the practicability with the environmental outcomes that the rule is trying to achieve.
Yeah, okay. I understand. We'll come back to that. So, do you agree that the, as far as, again, just coming back to stock exclusion, do you agree that the PC1 regulations proposed for stock exclusion and supported by my clients are significantly more stringent than the stock exclusion regulations?
Not entirely, because the way that the stock exclusion regulations apply is slightly different to those in PC1. In particular, where the requirements apply to different types of stock and the way that those stock are grazed. So the regulations have different requirements than PC.
But do you understand that the my clients, and I think everyone here understands, that the PC1 requirements sit on top of the stock exclusion regulations?
They are in addition to
yeah.
the stock. Regulations.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you need to meet both, depending on which applies to the particular water body.
Yeah, and just by way of some examples, the stock exclusion regulations only apply to 1 metre wide streets, don't they?
Yes.
Whereas the PC1 requirements are for any permanent or intermittent stream of any width.
That's right.
Which is a lot more stringent, isn't it?
I can't comment on how many more there will be.
No, it's more stringent.
Almost stringent, sorry. Yeah, well, like I say, the application of the regulations in PC1 are different. Yeah.
But both need to be complied with. So from a regulatory perspective, I think you agree both need to be complied with.
Agree?
Right. Yeah. So again, at a high level, do you agree in considering the nature of a setback, there are many factors for someone drafting a rule on a setback to consider, including, for example, the nature of the topography?
Yes.
The nature of the farming activity occurring in the adjacent stream?
The farming activity
mm.
in the stream?
Adjacent to the stream, in the
mm.
paddock adjacent to the stream.
Yes, to some extent.
Yeah. The sensitivity of the water body?
Well, certainly the sensitivity of any downstream receiving environment,
yeah.
but the water body itself, yes.
Do you agree from a very basic perspective, and based on Ms. MacArthur and other evidence, that from an environmental water quality perspective, a position is generally taken that the greater the setback, the better?
As far as I understand it, to a point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then it becomes diminished.
That's right.
But do you agree with me from a planning perspective and in terms of Section 32, you need to take into account a much broader range of matters than just water quality outcomes?
Yes.
And that may require a lesser setback that then might be ideal from a water quality perspective, Michael.
It may do.
Thank you. If we go back to your evidence then, thank you, I think we're up to 19. I've just got a couple of clarification points.
Paragraph 19.
Yeah, I'm at 19, sorry, I'm just, there's trouble with working on the electronic version, I now need to find it. I think it's about, oh yeah. Okay, so the stock exclusion and setback discussion starts at paragraph 128. Yep, so let's start there. You got that?
I do.
Yeah, okay. Then the regulatory impact statement you referred to at your paragraph 130, I was a little unclear from that. Is that the regulatory impact statement that I handed up, or is that the draft? Is that a separate one? It might be an earlier version, I just wasn't sure.
I'll just see if the reference is the same and then it might help us. This doesn't have page 316, so
okay.
I'm assuming the document.
Okay. Have you seen this document before? If you haven't, that's fine.
Powerful.
Okay, all right, that's fine. Okay, we'll leave that. I'll talk to you about that. At your paragraph 138, if we can just quickly go there, talks there about the stock exclusion regulations requiring a 3 metre setback. And then it says it's my interpretation that the requirement for this setback applies regardless of whether there is existing fencing, essentially requiring the fencing to be moved.
Yes.
Is that still your understanding of the regulations?
No, it's not.
So, sorry, was that something you corrected earlier?
I didn't correct that, no.
But that's not what the regulations say, is it?
That's correct.
So does it? So what should we delete that? Because Schedule 1 of the regulations has transitional provisions. So how would you like to change that? And Schedule 1, just for the members of the court, Schedule 1, page 10 of the regulations sets out in respect of permanent fencing, so not temporary, but permanent fencing. There's essentially an excluded savings provision for that, isn't there?
Yes. The part of the regulation one, part one.
Yes.
So, just reviewing Schedule 1, if there is a permanent fence or riparian vegetation that effectively excludes stock, then that can remain, but if there's not a permanent fence or riparian vegetation that effectively excludes stock, then the regulations would apply.
Right, so are you comfortable with that last sentence of paragraph 138, or would you like to amend it? Or would you like to amend it essentially requiring that and changing with these fences to any temporary fences will be moved? Would that be the easiest change? It's your evidence, you change it how you like. It's just important that it's accurate, that's all.
Sure. So I would add to the last, I'll get to the last line, it would be temporary fencing. So add the word temporary.
Well, as you say, that's very evidence. I've put a marginal note, which is the
fixed at this.
So I think with the addition of temporary in the second to last line, existing temporary fencing requiring that these fences will be moved, and then we've got a reference to the saving provision.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Bob.
So then if we go down to paragraph 141, and then in the last sentence you've got the appeal seeks to ensure that setback distances included in Schedule C are sufficient to achieve the removal of fine sediment from entering water bodies. Do you agree that any setback will achieve some sediment reduction? Yeah, and my clients are proposing a minimum of 1 metre, an average of 3. Do you? Is it your feeling, based on your water quality expertise, water quality expert, do you agree that that will result in some sediment reduction, but perhaps not complete sediment removal? But you heard my discussion with Ms. McCarthy when we talked about the Zhang graph yesterday. So that did show some benefit at 1 metre increasing up to 3 to 5 to 10 metres, didn't it?
That's questions for Ms. McCarthy.
Yeah, but from a planning, in terms of setting an appropriate setback, from a planning perspective, you'd need to have regard to that evidence, wouldn't you?
Yes.
And weigh up a range of factors, which you've said before.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And I think, just turning to 146, my friend talked you through the minimise versus prevent, so I don't need to talk to you about that. And then if we can go to Schedule C, minimum farming standards. So that's paragraph 164 of your evidence. Do you agree that these minimum farming standards are really the engine room of PC1?
They are one of the main drivers of
what
we're achieving the outcomes of PC1.
Yeah. So, at a very high level, the expectation is that every farm will meet the minimum standards, correct? If you want to go to, do you have a copy of it? If you can go to Schedule C, it might be easier.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, great. Yeah, okay. So every farm is the expectation is that every farm would meet the Schedule C requirements. Is that your understanding?
There are options to
meet
the requirements.
So, and then if you don't meet the Schedule C requirements, you need to apply for resource consent. Well, those are the only two options, aren't they? You've either got to meet Schedule C or apply for resource consent. So the wording of the Schedule C requirements are going to be quite crucial to determine the degree of flexibility in these provisions and also the number of resource consents that might be required. Is that correct?
Yes.
Do you know how many farms are within PC1?
I don't know.
I understand it's well over 5,000. You don't know, okay. Just in terms of Schedule C, so on your, and we'll come back to your provisions, but before we do that, if we go to your 169 of your evidence, it says there in the second sentence, therefore reliance on the MFE low slope map would not accurately identify those properties with a slope between 5 to 10 degrees. Do you see that?
Yes.
Do you want to correct that? Have you looked at the low slope map on the website?
I have.
And you'll see that does accurately identify the properties between 0 to 5 and 5 to 10 degrees.
I may have misinterpreted the map. That is the case, but my understanding was that it was showing land
okay, well, so if the map does accurately show, well, as accurately as that map does, if that map does show between 0 to 5 and 5 to 10, then you would accept that.
Well, I need to have another look at it, I think.
But you did have to, you had a look at it, but you might have missed it, though. Is that
yes,
what I'm saying?
That's what I'm saying.
Now, I'm sorry, I might have missed the... So, when you said you... Did you take out paragraph 174? Did you delete 174 from your record?
Yes.
Right. And, sorry, what was the reason... I might have missed... What was the reason for deleting that?
Because it's incorrect.
Okay. And, but you leave in the diagram. You have to leave in the diagram, you're just taking out
the figure above it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So you, that stays, but just 174 we've deleted it.
Yes.
Okay. Alright. Okay, we're nearly through with those. If I just quickly go to 181. And I think I've asked this, but you say that you rely on the evidence of those three witnesses and say that they should be specified as minimum farming standards. But I think you agree with me before, you need to independently apply your Section 32 planning analysis to choosing appropriate setbacks.
Yes. So since I've drafted my evidence, I've had the benefit of going to Mr. Berry's farm and reading the farming expert evidence. So I have a broader base on which to consider the setbacks than I did based on those three experts.
And that's good. I'm glad you've got that. But just for the record, despite reading all the farmer evidence and despite the visit to Mr. Berry's farm, you nonetheless still maintain your version of the provisions attached to your evidence?
Yes.
Okay. So let's then ask you some questions about those provisions. But before we do that, if I can ask you to turn to the map of Mr. Cameron map in front of you. So the red outline is Mr. Cameron's farm. The MEP stock exclusion low slope map is 0 to 5 as shown in the pink wash. You see that?
Yes.
The grey wash is 5 to 10, and then the clear is more than 10. So that's taken directly off the website we've just discussed. So you can see clearly that it does show the areas between 5 and 10 degrees. Okay. You'll see there this has also been prepared with Mr. Cameron's assistance. The yellow lines are Mr. Cameron's permanent fencing. The paddock layout.
Sure.
You see it?
Yeah.
Yeah. The dark blue is permanent, approximately 3.7 kilometres. The likely intermittence is slightly smaller blue, and then the likely, and that's 9 kilometres, and then the likely ephemeral is 5,000 metres. And again, the ephemeral, we'll come back to those, but they are rather mysterious things that appear and disappear. But that's an indication of where the location, and that's relevant to the questions I'm going to ask you because of the Director General's position that all of the ephemeral streams should be fenced. So, if we look at that next year, while I ask you these questions, do you agree that it's helpful when a planner is drafting rules or considering provisions to test those provisions against different scenarios?
So I want to do some, and you agree that the rules related to setbacks and fencing will apply differently on each farm?
The rules are the same.
Yeah, the application will be quite different, yeah. And you agree that the provisions, the setback and fencing requirements are also cumulative on each farm? All the different things that need to be set back and fenced all need to be added together. You agree with that? You need to do all the fencing on the farm. So, for example, you'd need to fence permanent and intermittent streams wider than a metre on low slope land because of the stock exclusion regulations, correct?
Yes.
Yep. So you can see the straight lines, all the permanent, Mr. Cameron describes them as evidence. They've made the line a little too thick, but you can see the permanent fencing, permanent streams fenced on both sides, but the yellow underneath's being sort of covered up by the blue.
Okay. Any of the intermittent streams,
You can see the paddock boundaries are there, so you'll see where the paddock boundaries. No, I can take them as Kevin's evidence, but essentially my understanding is the paddock boundaries are in yellow, that's the fencing. The temporary fencing is in green, and then you can see the streams underneath that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, cool. So just coming back to my question, so that any farmer would have to comply with all of the regulations and requirements around fencing, and I just want to quickly run through with you. So there's the permanent and intermittent streams wider than a metre on low slope land because of the stock regulations, correct? So it's for beef and cattle. Sorry, beef and deer.
Beef and deer.
Well, there's a range of animals that the stock exclusion requires to be excluded. Pigs, deer.
Yes. Are we talking about Mr.
Cameron? No. This is general.
Oh,
that's
right.
General. That's just with us in mind. So as a general level, we agree that farmers have to comply with the stock exclusion regulations. They have to fence the wetlands required by the stock exclusion regulations?
Yes, although there's no setback distance specified in the regulations.
No, but they have to fence them, yep.
Yes.
They have to fence the permanent and intermittent streams required by PC1?
Yes.
They'll have to fence potentially the wetlands down 50 square metres as you're currently proposing for PC1?
Yes, that's in PC1.
Yeah, and in the draft provisions at the moment, yep. They'd have to have cultivation setbacks.
Yes.
And they would need to manage critical source areas.
Yes.
And then all of those areas that are fenced and set back would need to be maintained.
The fences would need to be maintained.
Yep. Weed control.
I assume so. Farmer chose to do that.
Well, a good farmer would choose to control the weeds on their property, wouldn't they? So, and you can understand then just from looking at, and then turning now to ephemeral streams, because I understand that the Director General is the only party, and I may be mistaken, I understand is the only party seeking the fencing of ephemeral streams across all the farms in the PC1 catchment. Is that your understanding?
Yes, so my understanding from Ms. McCarthy's evidence and her oral presentation yesterday is that it's likely that ephemeral streams fall within the definition of a critical source area. So there's potentially not a doubling up, if you like, in the terms of requirements to manage ephemeral water bodies. There's already a requirement to identify in many cases and manage critical source areas. So I guess to clarify, in the case of
ephemeral
streams, those should be captured within the management of
those
critical source areas.
So, two questions. There's no requirement to fence critical source areas, is there?
No, there's not.
And fencing has a whole range of additional complications, doesn't it, which we'll come to, other than just manage it.
Well, yeah, I guess I'm not clear in PC1 exactly what managing critical source areas would require. The guidance is quite limited in terms Ministry for the Environment on critical source areas guidance for intensive winter grazing. We are managing protection of critical source areas identified as fencing, vegetation cover and vegetative buffers. So other than looking at that, I'm not aware of other management techniques of critical source areas.
So, for example, if a critical source area is around a trough, you're not aware of the management technique of moving the trough?
My understanding is moving the trough will be quite difficult.
Yeah, well, we'll come to it. Okay, but back to my question. Are you aware of any other parties seeking the fencing of all ephemeral streams in the Waikato, in the PC Waikato catchment, other than the Director General?
I'm not aware of that.
Okay. So, do you understand that my clients are extraordinarily concerned about the prospect of having to fence all the ephemeral streams on all the farms in the PC Waikato catchment?
I understand they may be.
Do you, is your proposal that ephemeral streams be permanently or temporarily fenced?
There's no requirement for permanent fencing.
So you'd suggest temporary fencing?
Yes.
So I put the question to Ms. McCarthy yesterday about temporary fencing of ephemeral streams, and she suggested that the farmer would look at the forecast, see if it's going to rain, and then go and put up a temporary fence around the ephemeral streams. Mr. Cameron has 5,000 metres, 5 kilometres of temporary fencing. It's simply not practicable, is it, that he would be able to temporarily fence his ephemeral streams every time it's going to rain?
He would only need to fence where there was stock in the paddock where the ephemeral water body was. So I don't know how Mr. Cameron farms, but he would only need to do that to exclude the stock. So it's a stock exclusion requirement. So if there's no stock in the paddock, you wouldn't need to fence the water body.
Right, but so you might only have to fence 2 kilometres of stream every time it's about to rain.
Yeah, like I said, I don't know how he farms, so it would depend on where the stock is located as to whether he needed to fence that particular ephemeral water body or not.
Just applying a sort of a planning principle to that, do you think it's sensible or reasonably practical for all the farmers in the Waikato who have ephemeral streams and paddocks with stock in them to go and fence all ephemeral water bodies prior to rainfall? Is your evidence as a planner that that's a reasonably practical alternative?
My understanding is that ephemeral water bodies will not present in all rainfall events. So it would be up to the farmer to understand their farm and when there was likely to be ephemeral flow from a water body to know whether to fence it or not.
But just back to my question, is it your evidence as an expert planner that that's a reasonably practical alternative?
I think it could be yes.
Yes or no?
I think it could be a reasonably practical option for a farmer.
Have you undertaken any assessment of how long it would take to do that work?
No, because I don't know how each individual farmer would farm.
So it could take 5 hours, 6 hours to do that?
I don't know.
If it was 5 to 6 hours to do that, would that be reasonably practical?
I guess it would depend on whether there were alternatives to managing the stock in a different way, moving them to a different paddock, where there's no ephemeral water body, for example, is another management technique that could be used.
And if you fence, so let's follow this through. So if you fence an ephemeral water body, how long do you wait before you can take the fencing down again?
So my understanding is that you would need to leave the fence in place while there was water flowing.
Right, and then take down the 5 kilometres of fence, 2 kilometres of fence.
Then you could take down any fence that you perhaps needed to put up to prevent stock from entering that water body.
And you'd have to take it down because you understand it's essential for animals to have access to drinking water, isn't it?
Is the drinking water the ephemeral water body?
No, the drinking water, the animals need access to drinking water, don't they?
Yes. Yes.
And that's one of the main problems with requiring additional fencing, isn't it? Because it needs to be water provided in every paddock that they stock. Do you understand that?
Yes.
And even at Mr. Cameron's example, so if we look back and just leaving ephemeral streams for the moment, if you look back at Mr. Cameron's paddocks, you'll see there even a requirement to fence intermittent streams is going to leave, or do you agree with me that that will leave a number of paddocks where Mr. Cameron is going to need to change his existing fences to have usable, practicable paddocks?
I can't comment on that.
Okay, because you've got no farm systems expertise.
That's right.
And if the evidence from the farming witnesses were that it's impracticable from a farm systems perspective to fence starting ephemeral water bodies, if the farm systems and farmer evidence is that it's simply impracticable to fence ephemeral water bodies when it's going to rain, would you accept that evidence?
Well, I would ask what other techniques they're going to use to exclude stock from ephemeral water bodies.
And I think this question was put to you. Ms. McArthur said that her primary concern with ephemeral water bodies was as they acted as critical source areas, correct?
That's my understanding,
yes. And the critical source areas are separately managed under PC1 without requiring them to necessarily be fed, aren't they?
Yeah, like I say, I don't understand what exactly Clean Change Model would require to manage critical source areas. I understand that that may be fencing, it may be vegetation cover, vegetative buffers, but I'm not aware of what the other management techniques might be. But fencing might be an option that a farmer would use.
Yeah, they might, but they might choose to use another option that might be more practicable for them on their farm.
Yeah, and if it's effective in managing that critical source area, then that would be fine.
So your primary concern, I'm just trying to get to the bottom of this primary concern around ephemeral water bodies. If your primary concern around ephemeral water bodies is the management of critical source areas, and if the court can be satisfied that the management of critical source areas can occur separately, do you agree with me that there'd be no need to fence ephemeral water bodies as a matter of course?
My primary concern with ephemeral water bodies is the contribution that they make to contaminants in the catchment. So that's my primary concern about them. If the court can be satisfied that Plan Change 1 sufficiently manages critical source areas, then and has options available for managing those critical source areas, one of which may be fencing, then that's fine. I don't have that same level of comfort from Plan Change 1 as it is at the moment.
But you've got there's no evidence for the Director General that says fencing of ephemeral water bodies in a rainfall, ahead of a rainfall event is practical, isn't it?
The focus of the
event
and the Director General's environmental challenges associated with ephemeral water bodies.
I understand that, but you agreed with me that you need to look at reasonably practical alternatives?
Yes. And so one of those is the management of critical source areas that's already required.
Yeah, agree with that. What I'm saying to you, I'm asking you, what is the evidence that you've relied on as a planner to say that fencing of ephemeral water bodies in advance of a rainfall event is reasonably practicable?
Well, I have considered the requirements of fencing as part of fencing ephemeral water bodies as part of the management of those bodies.
Oh, do you have it? Can you point me to any evidence from any farm systems, farming evidence, or any other evidence that the Director General or that you have relied upon rather, informing your view that the requirement to fence ephemeral water bodies ahead of a rainfall event is reasonably practical?
The Director General doesn't have a farm systems expert.
Do you have any evidence on which to say that fencing of ephemeral water bodies is reasonably practicable?
I don't have any evidence from the Director General's expert.
Or any other experts that says it's reasonably practical, do you?
Not in front of me right now.
Okay, can we then go to permanent fencing? So, my understanding is that your provisions require permanent fencing, all permanent fencing to be completed within a 2-year period, is that right?
Yes. So the provisions allow for temporary, permanent, or virtual fencing. So any of those three fencing options could be used to achieve the fencing requirements.
Yeah, and that's got to be required, and your provision says that it has to be done within 2 years.
Yeah, so during the planning conferencing, we discussed the actual application of the 2 years, and I can take you through the planning joint witness statement where we discussed that. Yes, sorry, I'm just trying to find it myself. So it is question 27.
Just back to your opinion, so thanks for pointing us to that, so I appreciate that. In terms of your opinion, are you, couple of things, are you aware that on a mixed stock farm with cattle and sheep, temporary fencing is not effective? You need to have permanent fencing to stop sheep?
Well, sheep aren't required to be
exposed
to the
wool bodies. No, but sheep push over. My understanding is that sheep push over temporary fences.
Right.
Were you aware of that?
Not particularly, no.
Right. So, I mean, that's relevant for farms that run a mixed stocking operation, okay? So, if they run sheep in paddocks, they need permanent fencing, so opposed to bad fencing. Okay. So, and then in terms of adjusting paddock layouts, so just looking at Mr. Cameron's example or any other examples, so the types of work that would be potentially required to fence is you'd need to do a plan of the whole farm where all the fences are going. That would be the first step. You'd need to make sure you could get water to each of the paddocks that are going to be separately fenced. Correct?
Sure.
Yep. You'd need to get water tanks put in the right place to feed the troughs. You need to get power supply potentially to the middle of the farm to run the pumps for the water supply.
Sure.
You need to locate your races, your gates. You need to make sure it all works from a practical perspective.
Yes, of course.
You need to get troughs and pipes into all of the paddocks to the right locations.
Yes.
And you'd need to find somebody to do all that work and have it completed within 2 years, right across the entire PC1 catchment.
Yes, so I accept that that is potentially challenging, which is why I pointed you to the discussion in the planning joint witness statement about potentially allowing for an extension of that time frame.
If you apply for a resource consent.
Okay,
so let's just run this scenario. So a farmer says, I've done my paddock layout, I now understand what I need to fence, I need to, I'm just not going to be able to do it within 5 years. So they apply for what sort of activity consent would it be? What type of activity consent would it be? Controlled activity?
Yeah.
So you apply for a controlled activity consent. You make the application. What you'd write an AE that would say what?
Well, your controlled activity would likely direct you to the matters of control that you were needing to consider. And I would expect that one of those matters of control would be in relation to the ability to fence.
Okay, just timing or some other things?
It would depend what the matter of control was limited to, but you could include availability of resources such as the actual infrastructure and the timing. And if there was I would suggest that there would be a plan for how you were going to achieve the fencing requirement.
Yeah, okay, so you put that into the council planning officer. The council planning officer might be getting 2,000, 3,000 of these from across the PC1 catchment because everyone's probably going to be in the same boat. So what's the council going to do with those applications?
Process them.
Yep, so would they need to do a site visit?
I would expect so.
Okay, so the council officer would come out and they would walk around the farm. And then they'd impose a condition, and what would the condition say? Assuming they grant a consent, which I guess it's a job activity they have to, what would the consent conditions be?
Well, if the plan had been prepared with the application that specified the timing to achieve the fencing requirements, I would expect the condition to essentially require that time frame to be met.
Okay. And then how long do you think that whole process would take?
The consenting process? Mm. It could be relatively straightforward because it's a control activity.
Right, but there's 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 of these applications that are lodged with council.
I don't know how many of there would be.
Right.
Because you could put up a temporary fence and you could comply with the requirements.
Not if you had a sheep.
Well, yeah, sure, maybe you don't put the sheep in that paddock.
Right. So, and then you end up with a time frame. My client's proposal, which I put to you, is more efficient and effective, is to give all farms up to 5 years to do all the fencing as a permitted activity from the operative date of the plan. And if they apply for a controlled activity consent, they can seek an additional 5 years from a 10-year maximum from the operative date. Do you agree that that would allow an additional period of time which should ensure that the bulk of the farms would be able to get their fencing completed without needing to apply for a resource consent?
Yes, I do. I think that we have known about plan change 1 for quite some time and that fencing would be a requirement. So I do know the likes of Mr. Berry have been very busy with his fencing, so it shouldn't be a surprise to people that from now that fencing is required. So I would have thought that people would have put some fencing in place where they were able to already.
So yeah, but no one had any idea about the fencing of ephemeral streams, did they?
Well, it's been in the Director General's submissions and appeals from the beginning.
Okay. So I think you've answered my question on that in terms of the timing. So we'll go then to the other minimum standards, and in particular the setbacks. So my client's proposal is that if you go to your Schedule C and if you go to number 2, and there's some specific distances, setback distances there, so you've got 3 metres, 10 metres, etc. You see those?
Yes.
Yeah. So, let me ask you another scenario, and that's that a farmer has walked around a farm with a certified farm planner. You're familiar with their roles, the certified farm planner roles?
So this would be under Schedule
D1? Or D1, like a certified farm planner. So list by given by kept by council, appropriately qualified farm systems expertise. Do you understand the role of a certified farm board?
Yeah, but my understanding is that Schedule D1 doesn't require a certified farm planner to complete the farm plan.
We'll come back to that because my client sees a much greater role for certified farm planners. But so you know who a farm certified farm planner is?
I understand their role.
Yeah. Okay. And so I put the scenario to you: a certified farm planner and a farmer walks around the areas that they are required to fence. They have their set of PC1 provisions in one hand and their tape measure in the other, and they're going around working out how they're going to comply with these setbacks. They come across an area of 20 metres of stream length that it's not practicable to provide a 3-metre setback because there's a great big hill in the way, and that to provide the 3 metres of setback, they need to cut about 5 metres off the hill and bench it back in order to get a 3-metre setback. And the farm planner says, well, we might get you 2.2 metres, but we can't get you 3 metres. In that scenario, under your rules, they'd need to apply for resource consent, is that right?
Yeah, unless they could find an alternative location for the fence that was further away.
Right. So, and then they apply for resource consent, and they go through the process of doing the drawing, showing how much hillside they need to cut away, how they're going to manage the sediment from the excavation, the hill is going to have to be stable after that, how it's going to be revegetated. They lodge an application for a resource consent to breach that standard from 3 metres down to 2.3 metres. A council officer comes out on site and looks at it. Do you think the council officer at the end of that process is going to require 3 metres of hillside to be chopped away in order to provide 800 mils of additional setback?
That will be an individual council officer's decision.
Do you understand that would be an inefficient process?
Yes, I do. And I think that you would hope that the farm planner would help the farm work with the farmer to identify a more suitable location for the fence than having to create all that extra work.
But at almost the various farm that you went to,
yes,
the literally that sometimes the streams are in the very bottom of the gully. The top of the fence can be 50, 60, 70 metres away, the top of the ridge line.
Yes.
So is your proposal to exclude the 50 or 60 metres?
Well, not necessarily. That's not the requirement that I'm saying, but that may be, in some cases, a more appropriate solution.
Do you agree with me that it would be far more efficient and effective for a farm planner to walk around with a farmer and for Schedule C to have the flexibility for the certified farm planner to certify that in this particular location of the stream length, a setback of 2.3 metres is acceptable?
My understanding is that a certified farm planner is not required to have any ecological knowledge to become a certified farm planner, so I would have some concern that they may not have all of the information they need to be able to determine whether that setback is going to achieve the environmental outcomes necessary or not.
Right, so when we apply for a resource consent, which is the counterfactual, the council planning officer won't have any ecological experience, will they?
They may do, they may not.
So in which case,
they may get some advice from an ecologist within the council to help assist them with that.
How much would that cost and how long would that take?
Councils often have in-house resources that they can utilise for assisting consent applications.
Okay. So my client's proposal, which I put to you, is more efficient and effective, is giving a certified farm planner the flexibility to work with the farmers to provide a setback of an average of 3 metres and a minimum of 1 metre from the identified streams. If there is a concern about the qualifications of the farm environment planner, do you think that could be addressed through the qualification requirements that the regional council might hold?
It may be able to.
And that would be a much more efficient process than seeking resource consent.
I still don't agree that those setbacks that you're proposing would be sufficient to achieve the environmental outcomes.
Well,
that's a question, that's a water quality question, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. I'm not convinced that they would be sufficient.
But I think you agree with me that in drafting a rule, you need to balance a whole range of factors, not just water quality outcomes, don't you?
Yes, but in particular, in plan change 1, there are requirements to achieve particular environmental outcomes from stock exclusion.
Right, and a 2.3 metre setback would still exclude stock, wouldn't it? Just lastly, your requirement maintains the 18 stocked unit limit, per hectare limit, in your Schedule C. Yes? Do you want to go to your provisions? They're on page.
No, I have them in front of me. I don't have a particular view on the stock units. I understand that people have raised that is a problematic number, and that there is, I'm not aware of what a more appropriate number would be. My preference to revert to the decision's version was related to more so to the 15 degrees than to the particular stock units.
And just on the 15 degrees, I didn't read anywhere in any of the Director General's evidence explaining the rationale for the difference between 10 and 15 degrees. Was that separately identified?
So I addressed the reduction of the 15 to 10 degrees in my evidence, which Mr. Trebilco has proposed.
Yeah.
And basically, I can take you there if you like.
Yes, but can you just tell me what evidence you relied on from that, or was it just a planning discussion?
So, my concern was that there was no planning evidence provided from Mr. Kambilko to reduce that number from 15 degrees to 10 degrees. So, essentially what my concern is that reducing the slope requirements would be less effective and it would be less extensive in terms of the fencing required and therefore less effective in achieving outcomes sought by Phase 1.
Do you agree with me that there is no reasonable or realistic prospect of all the land up to 10 degrees being fenced in the next 5 years across the PC1 catchment?
I couldn't comment on that.
Do you agree with me that if it were a concern, if land above 10 degrees were considered a concern, that could be addressed by the December 2024 plan change?
Well, my preference is that it remain as per the decision's version, and that 15 degrees remain the threshold.
But I think you would have seen from Mr. Berry's farm, you agree with me that fencing on the steeper the hill country, the more expensive the fencing?
I couldn't comment on that.
Okay. But you have no reason to disagree with that?
I couldn't comment on that.
Okay. Thank you. I think, let me just check. Thank you very much, Ms. Martin. Very helpful. Thank you, Your Honour.
To ask you about overseer, and it's right, isn't it? You've accepted that you're not an expert in the use of these tools.
Yes,
so
I hope you don't have too many questions.
No. Well, perhaps only that. Would you agree that for CVB specifically, oversee is not not an appropriate tool. And could you comment on whether there are good alternatives for CVP? To oversee?
Oh, I couldn't comment.
Couldn't comment on that either.
No, I'm not an expert on that.
Are you able to offer any evidence on what Mr. Barber has identified as development of a scorecard for CVP specifically?
I'm not.
All right. On policy 5, am I right that you're worried about the prospect of trading of contaminants?
Yes.
And so that's why you want to delete references to prioritisation of contaminants. Is that right?
Well, my concern with prioritisation of contaminants is that that it will unduly focus on a particular contaminant when actually in most subcatchments all of the contaminants, all four of the contaminants are important.
Yes, and did you hear Mr. Trebilco's explanation of what he was trying to achieve with Policy 5 the other day?
I can't recall exactly what he said, but yes, I did find it confusing.
Right, so you didn't end up with a clear understanding that he isn't trying to allow for nutrient trading. Didn't get that impression?
Well, no, not particularly. And the way the policy is written, as he's proposing it, would lead me to suggest that it is some sort of trading.
Right, even though we know that he isn't intending to have it used in that way.
Well, yeah, and that's where you have to read the words of the policy, don't you, to interpret it, because Mr. Trebilco is not always going to be here to interpret it for us.
And the words nutrient trading don't appear in Policy 5 either, do they?
No, they don't.
No. So do you at least see the planning and sense or logic in the concept of prioritisation of each of the four contaminants?
I don't see that there's value in that at this stage.
Right. Don't you think, though, that one benefit of it is that it will actually help responsible growers to make the most impactful use of their limited resources?
Well, I think that on an individual farm basis, if there are particular contaminants that need to be focused on with specific actions, that is appropriate, but that is the scale that I consider as appropriate, not at a subcatchment or EU scale.
But if you've got, say, a CVP farmer, grower, who operates across two subcatchments, and they have different contaminant profiles, can't you see that it would actually be quite sensible for them to put more resources into sorting out the subcatchment where the contaminant profile is riskier?
Well, I think there needs to be a consideration of both what is happening at the subcatchment level and at the farm scale. So both of those things. If you only focus on a contaminant that might be of concern in the subcatchment, if you could identify clearly what that was to be, that farmer may not be contributing significantly to that contaminant, and they may need to focus on something else at the farm scale. So I think it needs to be at both levels.
Right. see how another part of this prioritisation philosophy could be sensible if you could achieve a greater number of benefits from reducing one of the contaminants rather than the others.
Well, I think the direction of Plan Change 1 is that all four contaminants are important.
Yes, of course they are, but the question is whether you can see sense in taking an approach where you do more about the contaminants that are of most risk in a particular area.
Well, what area are you talking about? Because like I said, it would need to take into account the farm and the sub-catchment.
Do you think it could be appropriate to link prioritisation to the core values of PC1? Well, do you agree that improving the health of the river for recreational purposes is something that we're trying to achieve?
So we're trying to achieve the 25 minute, the vision and strategy,
mm-hmm.
which, this is a first step towards that.
But as part of that recreational use, for example, swimming in the river?
Yes.
And marking a kite is another
yes.
part of the puzzle, isn't it? And have you read Ms. Holmes' evidence for 14Z?
Some of it, yes.
Did you see the bit where she identified things like recreation, marking a kite, and then explained that some contaminants, like E. coli, can play a greater role than others? Did you see that part of the report?
Would you like me to take me to that?
Or do you recall what I'm...
I don't recall it, no. Specifically.
All right. Well, before we go there, I might just ask you and see what you think. Do you think that if for example, focusing on E. coli would play a bigger part in making the river more swimmable or food gathering healthier. Is that relevant when you then come to think about which contaminants should be prioritised? You agree with that?
Well, it would depend on the particular subcatchment that you were located in.
Sure.
E. coli is one of the four contaminants that Plan Change 1 is trying to manage.
Yep, and so if there was a subcatchment where really massively reducing E. coli would have those benefits, is that a subcatchment where a slight increase, for example, in nitrogen might be tolerable?
Well, I'd want to understand whether nitrogen in that subcatchment was already over-allocated or not. If it was already over-allocated, then I would suggest that no increase in nitrogen is appropriate.
Yeah, even if slightly increasing the nitrogen would massively reduce the E. coli in that subcatchment.
My understanding is that each of the contaminants have a different impact on water quality,
mm-hmm.
so I don't think you could... I certainly am not qualified to be able to explain what the effects of increasing one and reducing another are, but like I said, if it was already an over-allocation of the catchment, then any increase, in my view, is not appropriate.
And if it wasn't over allocated, what then?
Well, then there is potentially room for, I guess we're trying to maintain water quality, aren't we? So I would suggest that any increase is potentially inappropriate.
Even where an increase in one could hugely reduce another.
Yeah, and I'm probably not the best person to comment on that. I'm not a water quality expert.
Well, you're not, but you are a planning expert, and you are critical of policy 5. And I'm really just trying to put to you whether, if done in a careful way, is there actually some room for this idea of making room for prioritisation of contaminants in that, if it's done in a careful way?
Well, I think that any increase in a contaminant that's essentially traded off against a decrease in something else is quite different to offsetting and compensation, which is what Policy 5 says. So if Policy 5 is not intended to be offsetting and compensation, then the policy should be revised, in my view. But the amendments to Policy 5 that I have proposed seek to align it more closely with the principles of offsetting and compensation, which are now in the NBSFF.
Yeah, using that biodiversity.
Well, the aquatic offsets and compensation in the NBSFF, rather than biodiversity specifically.
But putting to one side the word that you're using, I guess I'm trying to get at the underlying idea, and I'm asking whether, if done carefully, is there any room for PC1 taking account of situations like the one I've given you before, where you might have a modest increase in one, but it might lead to a bigger decrease in another. Is there any room for that sort of thinking?
I guess I take my guidance from the objectives and the vision and strategy, and in particular it talks about obviously the restoration of water quality within the Waikato River, and it talks about, that's it, objective K. Objective H talks about the recognition that the Waikato River is degraded and should not be required to absorb further degradation as a result of human activities. So, an increase in any of the contaminants to me is further degradation.
Well, but isn't it improvement, not degradation, at least if you use one of the contaminants as the measure, like the E. coli example? You actually aren't further degrading it, are you? You're improving it.
But you mentioned that there would be an increase in nitrogen, for example, as a result, so that is further degradation in my view.
But isn't there room to sort of zoom out and take an overall look at it?
Well, I think...
It's degradation of the river, isn't it? So, yeah, isn't there room to look at it as a whole?
Well, in my view, if you increase any of the contaminants, that has the potential to result in further degradation.
Even though you're... The outcome of that is a huge decrease in some other contaminant, which will lessen the degradation.
Well, you're trading one against the other, aren't you? That's your scenario.
Cool. But to answer the question, you're saying...
I'm saying that any increase in contaminants is through the degradation.
Okay. You you support the blanket 10 metre setback, including the commercial vegetable production, don't you?
The setback is for cultivation, so it includes cultivation associated with commercial vegetable production, but is a blanket setback for cultivation.
Mm-hmm. And you support that?
Yes.
And I think your evidence is that's because there should be clear, robust and enforceable provisions relating to setbacks. Is that just about?
Yes.
Were you aware that FEPs certainly don't prohibit using setbacks or riparian strips or other measures?
Perceived effect. Yeah, my understanding is that there's actually no specific DBP rules that reference the minimum farming standards. So the only rules that would apply to CBP where Schedule C would also apply are the interim permitted activity rule, the restricted discretionary rule for the Whanganui Marina wetland, and the catch-all, essentially, discretionary activity rule.
Sorry, my question was, are you aware that FEPs don't prohibit using setbacks, riparian strips or other measures where appropriate?
Yes.
For CBP?
Yes.
And you know that those FEPs have to be certified in all cases when it comes to CBP?
My understanding is that the Schedule D1 farm environment plans don't need to be certified.
Yeah, but CBPs is in the D2, isn't it?
And all CBP activities are required to meet a farm environment plan under D3, then it would need to be certified.
Yeah, and if you came along to the council and submitted one without that certification, it just wouldn't be accepted, wouldn't be allowed to be accepted by council, would it?
I'll just have a look at the certification.
Sure. Having reread that, a bare maybe rough summary is that it has to be certified or a council won't accept it, right?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
So in that sense, it's enforceable, isn't it? The FEP regulatory approach is enforceable.
Well, particularly this schedule is associated with resource consent one. So, yeah.
And so that leaves clear and robust. I think you said it had to be clear, robust, and enforceable. So, in terms of those other two, have you read the rebuttal evidence of Mr. Barber?
Yes.
And do you agree with his explanations that there are good reasons why you wouldn't want a mandatory 10 metre blanket setback rule for CBP cultivation?
I noticed that he has outlined that it may not be appropriate in all cases. But I think from a main effectiveness and efficiency point of view, having a standard, minimum standard is useful.
Well, we're sort of exploring whether it's robust, which I think was one of your criteria. And if there are good reasons why you wouldn't have a mandatory 10 metre setback for CBP, then it would be more robust, wouldn't it? Yes, but for my sons, I'm only interested in CVP.
Yes, so what I'm suggesting is a standard for all cultivation activities.
Yes, and I'm putting to you that that immutable rule approach is not particularly robust when you know there's evidence saying there are good reasons why you wouldn't want a 10-metre setback in particular cases. Agree with that?
I'm not familiar with the term immutable rule. Can you explain it?
Immutable means can't be changed. 10 metres applies every time.
Right.
And I'm saying that's not actually a robust way to do it, is it? When you've got evidence from people in the know saying you don't actually need these mandatory 10-metre setbacks every single time. Agree with that or not?
Well, I think there is certainly requirements for setbacks from cultivation activities that need to be effective in achieving the outcomes that they're designed to achieve. So having a setback that doesn't do the job that it needs to do is not very helpful.
Thank you. Those are my questions.
Thank you, Mr. Minister. Mr. Ferguson, any questions? Thank you.
When I was looking at the scope of your evidence and set out paragraph 13, the matters the Director General have asked you to prepare evidence on, I just wanted to confirm you haven't expressly been asked to or addressed the issue of the development of Tangata and ancestral land with the scope of your evidence.
No, that's correct.
Thank you. I just wanted to follow up from a question my friend's just been asking you in relation to policy 5, and I just wanted to get some clarification around the implication of that. Well, again, when you were considering policy 5 and you suggested changes to that, did you give any consideration, perhaps the answer is no, given your previous point, any consideration of the potential implications of that for the development of the Tangata ancestral land and policy set relationship to policy 17?
I didn't. I think that Mr. Bruff has raised some valid concerns around the changes I've proposed for Policy 5 in relation to Tangawhenua ancestral land. And I guess my response to that is that I was trying to be more helpful in terms of ensuring that Policy 5 reflected the requirements of the NPSFM in terms of offsetting and compensation. So, as an unintended consequence of my changes, I understand that it's potentially made Policy 5 and the development of Tangawhenua ancestral lands more challenging as a result. So, that's, it is an unintended consequence of my changes.
Yes, and so, I mean, we can get back to the issue with Policy 5, it's the problem or the solution in that regard, but You would accept, wouldn't you, as a matter of general principle, that if we have got measurable and identifiable reductions within a subcatchment, for example, over a period of time, that there would potentially be some capacity or headroom, as people talked about it, for some development of some of the ancestral land that might result in some increase and discharges, but the cumulative impact within that subcatchment having regard to the headroom that's been created would still be tracking in the right direction, except that as a matter of principle.
Yes.
And I think in answer to my friend, I think he was talking about trade-off across nutrients, and I think your sensitivity here is that if you're talking about that, you're not talking about offsetting and compensation within the scope of policy.
Right. That's right.
And the way in which you address Policy 5, as I said, it's very much focused on what is the activity within that specific property that's being consumed and offset compensation relative to that property, isn't it?
Yes.
So do you think, given the potential issue that that has been unintentionally created, that perhaps that the solution maybe isn't in fitting with policy 5 to address the Tangatawhenua ancestral land concern, but possibly to further develop the Tangatawhenua ancestral land policy to make it clearer about that kind of headroom capacity movement, or add an additional and separate aspect of policy 5 that deals with Tangatawhenua ancestral land development that's somewhat different from the targeted focus that it currently has?
Yeah, I think either or both of those in combination could address that.
And we just need to think about what the wording of that might look like.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you very much. No further questions.
Is any other party present who might want to ask questions? No. Do you mind any examinations?
Yes, sir, just on one matter, please. Ms. Keswick, my friend Mr. Matheson presented to you a number of scenarios, and he stepped through a number of scenarios, but in relation to those scenarios, he talked about resource consent processes.
Yes.
And the requirement to, when considering application through that process, that the requirement to balance different factors.
Yes.
And of course, those factors include the practicalities, which my friend spoke in detail on. But in your opinion, are there other factors that should also be factored into that process in terms of issues of that region where that consent is applied for?
I haven't processed a lot of resource consents, but I have prepared applications for resource consent, and generally what you're doing is you are looking at the guidance that the document that you're seeking consent under is giving you in terms of the objectives and policies it's trying to achieve, because those rules have been developed to achieve those outcomes, so you need to be considering that direction from the broader document in your consideration of any application.
And in terms of your considerations, to what extent does the particular issues in a region play out? For example, in this region, the Waikato region, there is a concern around the extent of degradation in many water bodies. Does that play out in any of the considerations and the processes that you've
developed in? And like plan change might have been developed to specifically address those matters. So if you were considering a consent application under this plan change, then those would be key considerations.
Thank you, Ms. Kessler. Thank you, Your
Honour. Thank you. Mr. Ferguson, it's happened to cover my issues. Thank you.
Commissioner Hodges does have some questions for you. The good news is that you are no longer under cross-examination, and so I appreciate this is the first time you've given evidence before the court, so there's no restriction on you talking with counsel or others.